ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Seeing a loved one lose the battle against the bottle is hard, and it can be particularly tough for their children. Watching a parent drink themselves away raises so many questions, like why? Hi, I'm Miyuki Okiranta, and in this episode of Earshot's Remember Me series, producer Zoe Ferguson interrogates her memories of her late father Greg. Who was the man and the father behind the bottle? And what have Zoe and her sisters inherited from him? And just a warning, this story talks about addiction and mental health, so please listen with care. Here's Ghost in the Machine.
It's 2015 and I'm fast asleep, dead to the world. Not even the buzzing of my phone wakes me. I don't know it yet, but it's my dad calling. Half asleep himself, but in a different kind of fog. He leaves a message that he won't remember, but it's one I struggle to forget. The next morning, I see his missed call and panic. Is he all right? Did he have another fall?
You have one unheard message.
He's slurring. You're just like the rest of them. Not picking up because you don't want to talk to me. He says that I don't care. Who can he talk to? No one, he supposes, and he hangs up with a sigh.
End of message. To delete this message, press 7. To message deleted.
When you have a parent who's got an addiction, it can be hard to know the full impact. On you, your family, but it's also hard to fathom what they're going through. I didn't fully comprehend what alcohol dependency was, or that Dad needed help, until I was in my 20s. And then it was too late. My 26th year was Dad's last. He was 72.
Ideas and writing were what made him tick. And why did he stop ticking? Because he was no longer enjoying himself.
I think I knew the man who had already stopped ticking. A lot of what I remember is his ill health. But I also know that our brains are like Teflon for good memories and Velcro for bad. So what have I forgotten about him that I need to know? And how can I better remember the man I called Dad?
He looks like a hipster creative now. You know?
I chose those glasses for him.
Mum and I are looking at photos of Dad in the 70s and 80s. He's built like a thermometer, with long hair, round wire glasses, a tobacco-tinged moustache, long fingers fit for a pianist, and a glint in his eye.
His eyes were sort of sparkly and quite active and attractive.
So my mum, Annie, met my dad, Greg, in 1978.
I was mid-20s and he was 10 years older. Greg, when he had a few drinks, he was very chatty, he was very funny, very quirky, very entertaining.
And what was he doing for work at the time?
He had a small studio and he was basically making commercials for radio and occasionally television. He was ahead of his time as far as being creative and coming up with extraordinary ideas.
And then Mum fell pregnant.
And whilst pregnant, about 4 months pregnant, his parents insisted that he make a decent woman of me, so we had to get married, which we did, and moved into a house, which became the family home for many, many decades.
We learnt how to ride our bike on the same day in this exact area.
That's right, being pushed down a hill without training wheels. Just do it. But it worked.
But it worked.
I'm sitting in a park with my older sisters, Laura and Jessie. They're 5 and 8 years older than me. The park is a couple of blocks away from our family home that we called Burlo because it was on Burlington Street. Dad moved out when I was 5, so I don't really remember much about when he was at home with us. So I asked them, what was he like as a young dad?
He was the non-strict parent, the nice guy, the one that would buy you the expensive ice cream from the service station. The one that if you said, can we stay a bit longer, he'd concede, even though you'd know that he just wanted to get the hell out of there. But as you grow older, you do, you know, you knew that mum did everything. Mum was the parent. She was the one that set the rules and did all the hard parenting stuff.
What are some other memories of Berlo?
Being on his back?
Yes, going, the piggybacks.
And the hallway made such a noise.
Yes.
Yeah, mum loved it.
Yeah. He'd start in the lounge room, get on his back.
Yeah.
He'd sing and we'd walk all the way down the hall, all the way back. And then he'd take us to our beds and plop us onto the bed. And he would always spend time reading us books.
Yes.
And the typing noise.
Ah, yeah.
You'd fall asleep to the sound of him typing. Yeah.
What do you remember of Dad's drinking?
As a child, not much. I do remember the Guinness.
Yes.
I was always fascinated by this black drink that looked horrid. And I remember casks, like the cartons of wine in the fridge.
Yes.
And I think Mum shielded us pretty well against it. Obviously, as we got older and heard them arguing about it, we became more aware of the situation, yes.
No matter how much you try to shield it from the kids, they're aware.
But when Mum first met Dad, there were no warning signs of what was to come.
There was no red flags at the time. In the 70s, late 70s, everybody drank. It was just the norm. Especially being in the industry that he was in, advertising, the long liquid lunches. Everybody did it and it was acceptable. It wasn't a problem at the beginning.
When did it become a problem?
It wasn't until we had our third daughter, you, which was in late 1980s. That things started to unravel because the jobs dried up. He started taking up lawn bowls. And of course, it's one of the sports, if you can call it that, you can do with a drink in one hand. That was his priority. And I could not rely on him when I had dinner parties and people were coming over. I just didn't know what state he was going to be in when he did finally show up. He was not happy because of lack of work. It sort of spiraled. More drink, less work, more drink. It was a vicious cycle.
So Dad ends up sort of retiring in his mid-50s.
Not willingly, but the world retired him. His world shrank to just the club and the few mates he had and the alcohol. That was it. That's when I thought, this can't go on, and I made moves to separate.
Dad moves out of the family home and into an apartment, a stone's throw from his beloved lawn bowls club. I'm in kindergarten, Laura's 10 and Jesse's 13, and we see him on Sundays.
I think he was quite lonely. I think that's when it probably started getting, you know, the drinking morning to night.
But we knew that he wasn't going to stop.
No.
Because it was literally the only thing he had to live for, the only thing he was looking forward to. He admitted it. He goes, if I don't have it, then...
What's the point?
What's the point? He goes, most of my friends are dead. I can't get out of my house most of the time. My eyes are getting so bad that I can't read and write. All the joy has been drained. So what have I got?
And the child in me thinks, what about us? I'd always felt growing up that he didn't love us like we loved him. And for the first time, I admit this to my sisters.
He loved us.
When we were out for lunch with his mates, he'd always talk about Jesse and Zoe and how creative. You know, like he was so proud of his girls.
He was.
You know, he never said it in front of you guys.
Never said it directly. Never said it directly.
But I didn't know that. And in my eyes, there was a competition for his love, and I was losing.
Like, why are you choosing booze instead of your family?
Well, good question.
I don't think Dad ever saw it as his girls versus the booze. So, you know, it's complicated and it's messy. I think that the way he loved us didn't change. And I think it's unfair to judge someone's love for you based on their behaviour. The booze was, he saw that as a relief, as an escape, as a way to numb the pain or numb however he was feeling. That was his crutch.
He was never a very affectionate person. And looking back, I think somehow being loved for the first time by me and then by you girls was foreign to him, and it almost scared him because he never had it with his parents. He was made to feel, well, he wasn't the favourite son. That was very obvious. Even his mother said so, which was cruel, very cruel. They weren't kind, they weren't supportive, and they weren't on his side. So he had an uphill battle.
Do you remember the first time you said, I love you?
It was an afternoon with the sun streaming onto the bed. Yes, and I think he was a bit shell-shocked. And it was a long time before I could draw it out of him. He was not free with saying, I love you, not only to me, but to you girls.
Yeah.
When Mum and Dad were still together, Mum asked him to write her a love poem.
Have you read it?
No.
Oh.
Where is it?
I can't remember.
Mum goes off to rifle through her drawers.
Ah, that's it. Do you want me to read it?
Yes, please.
Just because we live together and talk about the future all the time doesn't mean I love you. And just because we make love and go out places as a couple and feel trapped most of the time doesn't mean we love each other. And just because I think of us as one, not two, and make plans for our future doesn't mean it is forever. But I can hope. Ferg. Looking back, I suppose that was the best he could do. That was his idea of love. And showing love and writing about love. He was not a very grounded, happy person. And alcohol was his best friend.
Seeing Dad's choice of best friend, Mum started eyeing me and my partying habits because, like any young adult, there were a lot of parties and a lot of drinks. My friends and I swung from party to party like monkeys in treetops until one day, Mum pulled me aside and said,
I'm worried about you. With that history, is it genetic?
When we think about what's inside us, we might think of our organs, our stomach, our heart. But further in, there's something else. Right there, where we hide our secrets, our insecurities, things we don't want others to know. Where we might store things that haunt us, memories, regrets, and the hint of someone else, the bits we inherit from our parents, the parts that we're not quite sure belong there. It's here that Mum worried I held Dad's insatiable appetite for alcohol, an addiction, an unwanted inheritance. That spectre, that fear of what I'd inherited, it haunted me. I ignored the seed of doubt and focused on something else I shared with Dad, a love of stories and the written word.
I remember once him saying, I'd be happy to have a monastic life surrounded by books. He said, yeah, I think I'd be quite happy living on top of a hill somewhere.
Dad and I shared books and ideas, and I've still got a big philosophy book of his. And I read it a lot after he died. As I searched for solace.
Please leave your message.
Hey, Dad, it's me. I just finished a chapter in your philosophy book, that one about the guy who doesn't like Descartes. You know the one, he says that the mind and the body aren't two separate things, but actually one and the same. And it's the things we do who make us who we are. But I loved his name for Descartes' theory. He called it the ghost in the machine. As if there's something inside you, haunting you, but really, it's just a part of you. Anyway, I thought you'd like that. Bye.
So the years go by. Dad's health is deteriorating. He's gone from walking freely to using a walking stick and then a mobility scooter. And he's sick.
As he was unwell, the older he got, even though it didn't take much for him to be affected by alcohol, it got to the point where we knew that it was affecting his health. He'd fall over. That would affect our lives. We'd have to come pick him up. So we got more worried about it because it affected his life and his independence.
His drinking landed him on the floor of his apartment and sometimes in a hospital bed, and he'd yo-yo between them. He hated being in hospital, and I hated visiting him there. I remember once walking down the corridor thinking, how could landing yourself here not make you want to stop drinking? To realise it's time to get help. But as soon as I got into that room, I'd put on a smile and try to perk him up. And he would usually have a joke or two up his sleeve to lighten the mood.
Do you remember when he was in hospital, he was in the bed and he had the little lunch pack next to him? It was like sandwich, little juice popper and a plate of grapes. And I was like, you're going to eat your grapes? And he was like, no, I'll wait for them to ferment.
But that joke ran thin when the cycle kept repeating. I remember once Mum and I came to get him from hospital and take him home. Mum was driving, Dad was in the front seat, and I was behind him in the back. We were all quiet. Until we got a few blocks from his apartment, and he said, can we make a stop? We knew where he wanted to stop. My eyes met Mum's in the rearview mirror. Mine said, hell no. Hers said, just do it. So we stopped at the bottle shop and she asked me to get out and buy Dad's wine. As Mum and I drove away from Dad's apartment after dropping him off, I was fuming. Why did Mum make me do that? I felt like I was poisoning my own father. And she said, if we hadn't got it for him, he would have tried to get it himself. And that involved a lot of stairs and a busy road. And that he would probably fall and have another injury. She was right. Nothing got in his way.
You know, he used to say, I'm sorry, I'm a burden. I know, I'm a burden. I don't want to be a burden. I hate being a burden. He felt so guilty for being that way. He hated it. He didn't want us seeing him like that. When we came to pick him up off the floor, he was just
mortified.
Yeah. What's more than embarrassed? What's
humiliated?
Absolute humiliation.
Yeah.
So for years he's trapped in this cycle. His bags of drugs and vitamins left untouched on his kitchen counter. Until one day his body just shut down.
On the Friday morning, early in the morning, I felt really strange. I was thinking of him. I felt as if it was this weird, like, letting go feeling.
Later that day, two police officers knock on Jessie's door and tell her the news.
And they said, are you Jessie Elias? I said, yes. Are you the daughter of? And I'm like, yes, here we go.
And so, just like that, Dad was gone.
But his death was not a shock and was not a tragedy. And I don't say that in a nasty, cold-hearted way, but he had been drinking himself to oblivion for a number of years. He almost had a death wish. So, in a way, it was a relief for us. And most importantly, to him.
The funeral was on the following Wednesday.
The family and the friends of Gregory Gordon Ferguson.
And as the pastor starts talking...
Here this afternoon we both reflect on Greg's dying, on his death.
I sit there, tuning into memories of him.
But more particularly, we like to look back and remember.
And then as soon as I've got one, it's gone again.
And as we do that, to pay tribute to his life, to him.
What are my memories of Dad? Am I actually remembering something real? Or just creating a memory from an old photo? Is that really me? Or one of my sisters who wore that dress and sat on his knee? Little snippets come to me of being read to in bed, of being bored learning to fish, of our trip to Tasmania, of hearing his deep laugh when we watched Blackadder together, of sitting in the back seat of his little red truck on Sundays with my head half out the window, tasting the salt on the wind as we got closer to the beach. My eyes sting and I'm swallowing hard. Staring at the coffin, I feel nauseous and ice cold, yet clammy. I remember seeing Dad shaking hands grow steady around a glass of wine. He put himself in that box, spits a voice in my head. Why didn't he do better? Why couldn't he have stopped drinking? For his health, for Mum, for us. And then my eldest sister Jessie stands to speak, and I snap back.
Dad's official name was Gregory Gordon Ferguson. To you in this room, though, he might have been known as Greg, Fergs, the Professor, Dad, Pop, or simply Mate. He held the centre of attention very well, but indeed preferred the peace of his private space away from the crowd. Today he has both. So we say goodbye, Dad, Greg, Fergs.
Please leave your message.
Hey, Dad, it's me again. I know it's kind of weird I'm calling you after you're gone, but it's nice to hear your voice on that little message. I read another chapter of your philosophy book, the Buddhism one, about that mother, you remember? And she lost her son and she tries to get him back. And he says, I can bring back your child. Just bring me white mustard seeds from a house that hasn't been touched by death. And she runs around and she knocks on those doors and she gets doors slammed in her face and she can't get those seeds. And she feels helpless. And then she realizes what it's all meant. And then she enters her first phase of enlightenment. And I love that story because I kind of feel like her right now. I know there are so many homes who have lost a dad. And we're just one of many, many grieving right now. I love you. I miss you.
Like many families before us, we had to sort out the mess death left us with. Cleaning out Dad's apartment was a process, having to wade through the remnants left behind, dismantling the structure of his life. What can we keep and what should we throw away? The tangible and intangible things that he's left us with. Amongst the clutter, the dusty typewriters and cameras, there were drawers full of his writing. His plays, his stories, his poems. I had no idea he wrote so much. Discovering these was like uncovering artifacts from another civilization and trying to piece together the people who created them. Reading his poems, I learned two things about him. The first, I write just like him. The flow and the pattern is the same, which is wild. And the second, I learned how sad he was. There's one poem of his that's especially haunting. All the flowers in my life have hollow blooms. The house I rent has many empty rooms. and those I thought to be my closest friends now seem just personal odds and ends. The garden I so carefully laid in rows has withered in the wind that autumn blows. All the flowers in my life have hollow blooms, and silence runs the house of empty rooms.
I'd say if you look back at a lot of the poems he wrote, I think it was more than just a bit of anxiety. You knew that he was anxious. I remember him talking, he goes, "Oh, you've got my nervous energy."
Laura and I nod. Us too, we think. We carry more of him than we realise. And after all of this, I've learned too late that Dad was living with more demons than I knew. But I've also learned that I don't carry them, so I've got nothing to drown. And Mum's no longer worried I'll go down the same path as Dad.
It's not going to spiral out of control because you know the signs, you know yourself.
And so what do you remember of him when you see me and Laura and Jessie?
You all have different qualities of him. Jessie's very lateral thinking and quick-witted. Mm. Laura's got the soft. And he was. He was very kind and he was very soft. He was a gentle soul. And I think Laura's got that. And you, well, you've got the radio bug. So, yeah, I see a little bit of, but different aspects in each of you.
How do you think he would have wanted to be remembered?
I think he would want to be remembered for his creativity and some of the interesting creative projects that he got up and a few he won awards for.
So how am I now living with Dad's memory? More gently, that's for sure. Hearing more about his early years and what came before me, I feel like any resentment I had about his drinking has dissolved, and I'm left with these shards and fragments of memories, some mine, some borrowed, that I get to piece together to remember him better, and perhaps closer to how he would have liked to be remembered.
He had a disappointing life, but I hope you three won't. Learn by the mistakes of the people that went before you.
Beautiful. Thank you.
This number has been disconnected.
Ghost in the Machine was produced by Zoe Ferguson. The supervising producer was Kirsty Melville, and the story consultant was Sophie Townsend. Sound design by Wayne Ewan. And if this story has raised any concerns for you, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14 or the 24/7 Alcohol and Drug Support Line on 1800 198 024. I'm Iyukiyoki Ranta. Next time on Earshot's Remember Me, we visit one of Australia's most remote Aboriginal communities, Balgo, a community crying out to be remembered. I'll catch you then.
I'm Faza Draki, and if you like stories about people getting into trouble, taking risks, falling in love, making mistakes, getting out of trouble, then you should come listen to Days Like These. We've got stories of crime and redemption, near-death experiences, and a kid who just wants to swim really fast.
Sat my parents down in a very official type meeting at the age of 8. I told my parents wearing this blue ribbon, I've decided I'm going to be an Olympic swimmer. That's what I'm going to do with my life. Because it's obvious, you know, pointing to my blue ribbon, I'm good at swimming.
That's Days Like These. And you can listen right here or on the ABC Listen app.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.